So you might remember from your childhood, Sherry Lewis had a song that never ends, and this class is actually a song that never ends because this is a continuing loop that runs from fall to spring to summer to fall to spring to summer to fall to spring to summer, going on now for around 5 years without any break other than the food. I don't want to complain. Other than a week here or not. So the net result is, because every single session has overlapping students, so as a result, if you've been here before, you might hear some things that I'm going to say, but for some of you, hopefully it'll be new, simply because this is a loop that keeps on going. And this course is about halachic issues in what you might call contemporary society. So we're not necessarily going to go over the nitty-gritty of how you daven or how you keep Shabbos, although I'm always very, very happy to answer any questions at all. But more or less kind of what you might call cutting-edge issues, whether it's organ donation or surrogate motherhood or the like. But of course, we're going to touch on everyday halacha as well.
Hi, Rabbi. Okay.
Shalom.
Shalom Aleichem. Just want to introduce the rabbi. This is Rabbi Breidowitz. Rabbi Breidowitz is one of the Rosh Hashivas at Or Sameach. And Rabbi Breidowitz was a law professor in University of Maryland. Mm-hmm. So anyone that wants halacha and also someone with background in secular law?
Yes. Okay.
This rabbi has it all. Anyone that wants halachic authority, people come and ask me halacha, I always tell them I'm not a halachic authority. So,
thank you. Okay, so as I say, you know, we deal with some contemporary issues, and we cover basically a number of discrete areas. We have a long medical ethics issue, we have issues about Israel, we have issues about marriage and divorce, issues of Shabbat and technology. Those are the kinds of things that we cover. Yes.
And then there's a trip going
to be okay, that's fine.
Unfortunately, it was an oversight.
Okay.
So
very short. Okay, that's fine. Okay. Yeah, right. Because of different fast days, this is going to be very abbreviated. I think we'll only have two classes, but okay. But hopefully, you'll get a taste and come back for more. So I wasn't sure what to talk about tonight because, again, there are so many different topics that we do cover. But I thought, you know, the Supreme Court issued this week a very, very controversial opinion. And it was so controversial that even within the Supreme Court, it was 5-4, meaning one vote would have changed it. And unfortunately, because of the internet filter in my office, I can't even read the opinion because they censor anything that has the word homosexual in it. So I have to wait till I get home and look at it. But basically, what the Supreme Court did was the Supreme Court legalized, as a matter of constitutional law, gay marriage. Now you understand. Now, if you have any legal background, you have to know that's extremely important, because by making something a constitutional right, that takes away the right of any state to restrict it in any way. Meaning, they didn't simply say gay marriage is okay, they say gay marriage must be recognized by every single state in the United States, because it is grounded in the constitutional right of privacy that gives people the right to make these intimate decisions. Now, I don't want to spend a whole hour talking about homosexuality and the like, but I just want to give you a few perspectives on how an Orthodox Jew, a Torah observant Jew, would approach this issue. First of all, as a very basic idea, you all have to know that there are actually two different systems of law that God has given the human race. To the Jewish people, God has given the Torah. The Torah is divine, but it's only given to Jews. Non-Jews do not have to keep the Torah. And not only that, but we don't proselytize. Judaism is a bit unique, that we believe that non-Jews can get Olam Haba, they can get salvation, without being Jewish. Right? We don't require anyone to convert. And even if somebody wants to convert, we initially discourage them. Because the road to salvation for human beings is not exclusively through Judaism. So Jews have to keep the Torah, 613 commandments, although many of them don't apply today. But non-Jews also have a Torah that comes from God. And the Torah that comes from God for non-Jews is called the seven commandments of Noach are often in English, they're referred to as the seven Noahide laws. And you can actually find websites that are devoted to the Noahide law and the like. Now, the seven laws, some of them overlap with the Ten Commandments, but they're not exactly the same. Let's just enumerate the seven Noahide laws so we have an idea of what they are. The first is a prohibition against idol worship, which essentially means belief in one God. In other words, one is expected to be a monotheist. The second is a prohibition against murder. Don't take life. A third is a prohibition against adultery and incest. Again, that mirrors the Ten Commandments, right? That's the third. The fourth is a prohibition against severing the limb off an animal when it's alive. We could call that broadly a cruelty to animals law, a law about not being cruel to animals. A fifth is blasphemy. One is not allowed to curse the Almighty. I'm missing one here because what did I miss? One second.
Is it mute?
Huh?
Adultery?
Adultery I did mention. One second. Huh?
I think courthouses.
Yeah, that's the seventh one. But why am I missing? Why am I missing the sixth one? One second. We have
steal.
Oh, steal. That's right. Yeah, stealing. That's right. That's a biggie. Yeah.
That's right.
Okay. And the seventh one is the duty to establish a court system to administer justice in an even-handed way. And these are the seven pillars of Noahide law that God expects even Gentiles to keep because they are basic morality, and that morality is grounded in what you call ethical monotheism, the belief in one God. Now, according to the Rambam, according to Maimonides, it is actually an obligation on the part of the Jewish community to foster and encourage not people to become Jewish, we don't do that at all, but to foster and encourage adherence to the basic Noahide tenets of morality. Now, we don't foster it necessarily by coercion, right? We're not going to go around breaking people's windows if they're committing adultery or whatever it is, but by education, by persuasion, by campaigns. Now, you may say, well, gee, I haven't seen that many Jewish rabbis kind of talking about people keeping the Noahide law. Well, the truth of the matter is, historically, we have not done that too much because we've been more worried about our own. And there is a sense that when all the Jews are keeping the Torah, then we'll work on the non-Jews. But Lubavitcher Rebbe, among many other things, among his many, many projects, did actually have a project designed to encourage the adherence to the Noahide laws among the Noahides. It's interesting, there are websites of Noahide, and again, to Christians, this is very confusing. A Noahide Gentile is not a Christian. A Noahide Gentile does not believe in Jesus. A Noahide Gentile believes in the Torah that God gave to Moses, but doesn't keep that Torah because he's a Gentile. It's a very, very strange, unusual type of situation. It is the religion of monotheism, of which the Jews are considered to be the priests, meaning it's an interesting analogy. Just as within Judaism, Kohanim have laws that the rest of the people don't have, so Noahideism is essentially the religion of the world of which Judaism is the priestly code for the Jews who are the Kohanim of that world religion. So if you're a Kohen in Judaism, you're the Kohen of the Kohen, so to speak. So you would understand that Christians don't understand this. I know in the Wall Street Journal, there was an article around 20 years ago already, in which some church had taken down its crucifix, and they became a Noahide congregation. And the Texas Baptists didn't know what that meant. If they would have become Jewish, they would have at least understood what that was. They didn't know what Noahides were. The only thing it could be was devil worship or something. They could not figure out what it is. But theoretically, there would be non-Jewish rabbis. I don't know if they'd be called rabbis, who would guide their Gentile congregations in following the Noahide laws in a proper way. Now you might say, well, what do you need rabbis for? Are Noahide laws so complicated? Well, yeah, they are complicated, the same way Jewish law is complicated. For example, the Noahide law, that's the one that I missed, is don't steal. Okay, but is cheating on your taxes stealing? Making long distance phone calls at work, is that stealing? Is playing solitaire during business hours, is that stealing? Right? Now, these are questions that we as Jews have to face. And indeed, these are questions we have to face as Orthodox religious Jews, but non-Jews have to face them as well under the Noahide law, because if they're using up their employer's time and they're getting paid for it, they are stealing, right? Take home office supplies. So just like you have to have rabbis and halachic authorities for Jewish law, there would actually be rabbis and halachic authority for Noahide law and the like. And eventually, there would be non-Jews that could do this, but presently they tend to go to Jewish rabbis. Jewish rabbis tend to guide them in the laws of Noah. So it's very, very intriguing. Now, why is all this relevant? The reason all of this is relevant is that all of us know that in Leviticus, Vayikra, Chumash Vayikra, the Torah does prohibit at least male homosexual activity. Now here you have to be a little specific and maybe a little gritty and more explicit than I would be fully comfortable in being. The Torah does address male homosexuality, and by male homosexuality I don't mean proclivities or attraction to the other sex. You know, a person has an attraction, that's not a sin. That's just the way a person might be, but I am referring to what you might call actual sexual genital to genital or genital contact. The Torah says among two male homosexuals that is a capital crime. That is actually an avera, a sin, for which there could be a death penalty. Now, we have to put that in perspective. There are many, many sins in the Torah for which there is a death penalty, including adultery, including violating Shabbat. But if you studied the Gemara, you know, the oral law, you know that the requirements for a death penalty are so strict that it's almost impossible for somebody to actually be put to death. The Gemara tells us if a Sanhedrin executed a person once every 7 years, and according to one view, once every 70 years, it was called a bloody court because it almost never happened. And the reason is, there have to be two eyewitnesses that actually see the crime. Now, how often are you going to have witnesses who are in a bedroom when people are having sex? Not going to be that often. The two witnesses have to be men. The two witnesses have to be Jewish. The two witnesses have to be religious, halachically observant, which again is not going to situate them in that type of environment. They cannot be related to either the victim or the perpetrator. And they cannot be related to each other. They have to have eyewitnesses, meaning if they're standing outside the bedroom, that wouldn't be enough. Right? The Talmud gives an example of murder where they run into a room and they see a man standing over a corpse with a knife dripping blood. Not good enough. They have to see the thing. And, to put a cherry on the cake, they have to warn the person before he does the act, don't do this or you will be killed. And the person has to say, I hear you, but I don't care. Because maybe he can claim he didn't hear it. In addition, the witnesses who come to a court to testify that these are deserving of death, they are cross-examined separately. And if there is the smallest discrepancy in their testimony, even on a minor detail, we throw it out. So for example, you're describing a murder, an eyewitness, you gave warning, all the things. They would say, okay, what color socks was he wearing? And if you say, I don't know, or one says black and the other says navy blue, sorry, contradiction, we don't accept the testimony. To make things even crazier, the size of the court you need to convict somebody of death penalty is a huge court. There's no court in the world that this big. You need 23 judges. No, the highest Sanhedrin was 71, but they were not a trial court. The trial court for capital crimes, 23 judges. And one of the oddest rules of halacha is, if they unanimously vote for conviction, he goes free. So if it's 22-1, he gets executed. But if it's 23-0, we say, hey, if nobody could think of something good, this must be a conspiracy. Because everybody has some defense. So 23-0, person goes free. So with all of these rules, you'd almost think the ACLU made these up because, you know, the guy's always going to get off. So when I say the Torah gives you a death penalty, that doesn't mean it's actually going to happen. I mean, God will punish all sins, of course, unless you do tshuva. But practically, the death penalty was not commonly administered, but the fact that even on the books the Torah says there's the death penalty for homosexuality, homosexual sex, I mean, right, actual genital contact, tells us how severe and how chamor this aveira is. Now, I'm sorry, there was a different hands up. I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm sorry.
I was just wondering the seven Noachalot.
Yep.
Are they being kept if it's not with the intention for Hashem?
Yeah, that's a very excellent question. The Rambam Maimonides has a very fascinating passage that says that a non-Jew who keeps the seven Noahide laws has a share in the world to come, just like a Jew. Very important. But Maimonides says that is only if he keeps them because he believes that God gave these commandments. If he is keeping them because of common sense or rationality, but not because he believes in God, he would not necessarily get a share in the world to come. Others differ. Maimonides is not the only view on this. Maimonides does say specifically that the fact that a non-Jew didn't kill and didn't steal does not automatically give him reward if he's not doing it for a religious reason. Yeah?
Hashem specifically, or could it be like the Christian?
Yes, well, that's a very excellent question as well, and that is an old... It's good that we go on to topic here, because that is an old debate in halakhic literature. What is the status of Christianity and Islam? Now, Maimonides writes that Islam, and Maimonides lived in Islamic countries in Egypt, Islam, as violent a religion as it is and as corrupt as a religion as it is, especially today, is a monotheistic religion. They do believe in one God, and consequently, in Islam, a Muslim is not an idol worshiper, is not a pagan, and if he keeps these laws because he believes in God, he would get reward. Of course, the problem is most Muslims, well, not to say most Muslims, you know, I don't want to talk about the Arabs because it's too controversial, but I will just say that, you know, there are 1 billion Muslims in the world. 1 billion Muslims. So people say, why are we so critical of the Muslims? You know, the radical element is only a tiny percent. 90% of Muslims are peace-loving and good people. Well, let's make that true. If 90% are peace-loving and only 10% are violent, well, what is 10% of a billion? That is, let's see, that's 10 million, right? So 10 million. So no matter what your percentages are, you're dealing with huge, huge numbers. But Maimonides does say Islam is a monotheistic religion. What about Christianity, that believes in a trinity and believes that God, on some level, took a human form? So that's a big, big argument. Maimonides actually says that Trinitarian Christianity, which was the only Christianity he was aware of because this was pre-Reformation, is idolatry, is paganism. But the view of many other commentaries is that although Christianity may be an erroneous belief, we're not saying it's true, of course, it's an erroneous belief, but it fundamentally affirms the existence of one God. And that has major repercussions because according to the halakha, you're not allowed to have idol worship in the land of Israel. So it's interesting that according to Maimonides, we would not be allowed to let Christians stay in the land of Israel. According to Rabbeinu Tam and Rashi, we would be allowed to. So that itself is a very, very big machlokas. Now, if you have various Protestant denominations like Unitarianism, that for sure is not idolatry, because that just believes Jesus is Messiah, Mashiach, and they don't give him any divinity, so that would be not Avodah Zarah. Okay. But be this at night, homosexuality is one of the... we have the seven Noahide laws. And the point I want to make is that homosexuality is not only forbidden under the Torah law. Because if it would just be a question of Yikra, Leviticus, that would not apply to non-Jews. Because non-Jews are not bound by the Torah. But the problem is that the prohibition against male homosexuality, I'll talk about female in a moment, is not only rooted in Vayikra, which is the mitzvah of the Torah, but it also applies to non-Jews via the Noahide code, because it is treated as a subset of the sexual prohibitions. Adultery, incest, homosexuality, bestiality, these are all included in the prohibitions. So, here is the thing. So, as far as pure halacha is concerned, the practice of homosexuality is forbidden not only under Jewish law that applies to Jews, but even under the Noahide Code. Now, what does that mean for me as a Jew living in a liberal democracy? Putting aside the Supreme Court opinion, should I push for restrictive laws against gays? Should I push for discrimination? Not necessarily, because I think most of us understand that in a society where different people have different religious beliefs and some people have no religious beliefs, and we have separation of church and state, it's not always a good idea to push for restricting people's freedoms. Because the reason is, if I successfully push to have a gay person's rights restricted, and I may think that's a good thing because I don't believe in homosexuality, I could have a Christian majority trying to restrict my rights as a Jew. So one might argue that Jews are better served by a secular government not getting involved in religion, rather than getting involved in religious matters, even if sometimes it works with my agenda, because it could equally backfire and work against my agenda. Which means one might say that on many, many religious matters, it is better for the state to be neutral and non-committal, so that I could practice my Judaism according to my beliefs, and even if other people are making decisions that I consider wrong and immoral and even evil, at least my ability to live as a religious Jew is not being compromised. You see the point? This is a bit controversial. Meaning, even if the stance of being non-committal means that certain evils are going to be happening, that still might be better than having a state that is punishing people for exercising their decisions, because that could backfire and limit my religious liberty. That's a sustainable position. However, the point is this. There is a big difference between being neutral and being hands-off and affirmatively giving a stamp of approval. If you have a state that simply doesn't criminalize homosexuality, a state that says people can do what they want in the privacy of their homes, they can do what they want in their bedrooms, we are not going to break down house doors and look at what people are doing, even though that means a lot of people are doing sins behind closed doors, I think Judaism could say, okay, right now we're not in the place where we force people to do things, just like we don't force Jews to keep Shabbos. Nobody's going to go over to you with a gun on Friday and say, make kiddush or else, light candles or else. Or you're walking into a Treif McDonald's, no one's going to, you know, kind of whip you. Because we understand that the way we teach Torah and the way we teach religion is not by coercion and not by force, but by persuasion and by education and by inspiration. And I can accept that. So I don't necessarily want the government, even in Israel, to be the Taliban, forcing people to do things. So, as a result, I think an Orthodox Jew doesn't have to be anti-gay in terms of laws. Right? You know, you don't have to say, I want laws that, you know, criminalize homosexuality. But the legitimation of gay marriage is a very, very different thing. It's one thing for the government to say, we're going to not endorse things one way or the other, let people do what they want behind closed doors, as long as they're not interfering with other people. But when the government issues marriage licenses and legitimates ceremonies, that is not being neutral. That is saying, this is good, this is equal, this is kosher, this is just as valid as a heterosexual marriage. What you have under those circumstances is not tolerance of moral evil. What you have is validation, acceptance, and approval. And that is very different. I want to make it very clear. I am not at all against, and actually it's not me, I'm trying to express what I think the Torah would say. We are not talking about discriminating against gays. We are not talking about denying them employment opportunities. We are not talking about criminalizing their behaviors. And we're not even talking about forbidding them to make civil union contracts in which they could make private agreements about health insurance and bank accounts. For that, I believe a Torah Jew could be laissez-faire and say, all right, listen, I'm sad that this happens, but people do what they do, and God will sort it out. But I think the one thing that is especially troubling about what the Supreme Court did is, the Supreme Court said that's not enough. It's not enough to let gay people do what they want to do, but every single state has to say, Mazel Tov, Yasher Koach, good thing, we approve. And not only that, but by making it constitutional, a state doesn't even have the right to go the opposite. The states must do this. And that, I think, is very, very different. There's a big difference between not protesting negative phenomena, which sometimes might be justified because you have to pick your battles in life. You can't fight every battle. Versus active endorsement. And you actually see this in the Gemara itself. The Gemara itself, it's really prophetic. It's amazing. The Gemara has a statement that goes back thousands of years. It talks about Sodom and Amorah, right? You remember the story, Sodom and Amorah were the cities that were evil and corrupt. In fact, the word sodomy comes from Sodom. And among their many crimes, well, they had many, many different crimes. They were cruel, they were callous, they mistreated the poor. But their other averos were the open practice of homosexuality. And the Talmud says the following. Sodom was not punished because they practiced homosexuality. They were punished because they made ceremonies and they wrote a ketubah, which is a marriage contract. Meaning, it wasn't the doing of the avera that was so bad. It was the legitimating of the avera. See, there's a difference between doing a sin and knowing it's a sin, and doing a sin and defining it as a good. Intermarriage was the same thing. You know, even 50 years ago, when I was younger, there were always Jews who intermarried. But a Jew that married a non-Jew understood that if they were invited to a Jewish wedding or they were invited to a bar mitzvah, the non-Jew understood that they wouldn't come. They understood that this was not something that should be at a religious event. That's not true today. Today, everything is in your face. Today, it's not enough that, you know, we don't complain, we don't criticize. You have to accept, you have to endorse. Same thing with gays. There have been gays since biblical times, if not before. They've always existed. But now, it's not enough to be tolerant. It's not enough to be accepting. You now have to say, no, it's good, it's good, it's good, it's good, it's good. The whole in-your-face mentality is very symptomatic of our time. So, again, I do want to draw the distinction here between a laissez-faire policy of neutrality, which one could argue, again, even that, some people are stricter than I. Some people say, hey, how can you be neutral? This is a sin. So some people are strict even in terms of allowing. They say it ought to be criminalized. Okay. I'm saying a different position. I'm saying one could understand hands-off neutrality. One should not support the notion of affirmative support from the state that this is a legitimate and proper thing. And if it just would have been a violation of the Torah, that wouldn't concern us because the Torah applies to Jews, not to non-Jews. But this is a basic tenet of the Noahide morality as well. Now, just to give you an example of how perverse it is, if you go to YouTube, not that you should look at YouTube, but if you go to YouTube, there is a rabbi who calls himself Orthodox. He happens to have Orthodox ordination. What can I say? Technically, he's an Orthodox rabbi. He's openly gay, and he conducts gay marriage ceremonies for people. And you see two men under the chuppah, and he recites Sheva Brachas. He recites the seven blessings. You know, that really is an awful, awful thing, because he's taking a Jewish religious ceremony. In fact, that's worse than the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court was talking about secular marriage. Okay, that's bad enough. He's taking Jewish marriage, and he's taking Jewish marriage and he's putting it onto something that the Torah labels an abomination. Yeah.
My question is, you say that anything less than neutrality is laissez-faire, but wouldn't you say anything less than equality would be laissez-faire and expecting more than equality, like a higher level of treatment, or acknowledging that it would somehow be better as more in your face?
Well, I would say this. I mean, again, I think from our perspective, and again, in a pluralistic society, it's difficult to argue why our perspective should dominate, but from our perspective, I think giving heterosexual union a preferable, more elevated status is not automatically the same as denigrating the rights of people to form their own unions. Meaning, we're basically saying the following. We are not interfering with people's choices. People make choices, whether they're right or wrong, good or evil. Human beings are creatures of choice. God gave us choice. So we're not going to punish you. We're not going to take away.
What if their choice is to be equal to you?
Huh?
What if their choice is to be equal to the heterosexual?
Well, I would basically say that, if God did ordain that the sanctification of marriage as a holy relationship is between men and women, that cannot be changed by definition. Now, one possibility, which some politicians have advocated, is that don't call it marriage, but call it a civil union. Meaning, if you have a gay couple, and the gay couple finds difficulty in getting health insurance, or they find difficulties in sharing bank accounts or sharing assets, and therefore they want to be married to be able to have these legal abilities, so it's possible to create, to give them those economic rights by calling it a civil union or a partnership or the like, the same way a man and woman who are not married can enter into similar agreements. But to call something marriage is a different level, because marriage historically has referred to a sanctified union. So,
but if it's also your distinction between civil unions, ones put forth by the state, that's them defining marriage as in a certain way, just short of marriage itself. But if the state says that gay marriage is legal, but not, it can't say on the religious side, because obviously they can't make.
No, that's correct. That is correct. That much
is
correct.
Is there anything wrong with that?
Well, I think there is. I think there is, because marriage is an institution that, even from a secular perspective, was grounded in religion, and that's very, very true. For example, to this very day, marriage is the only relationship, governmental relationship, that can be created and typically is created by a religious minister. Now, there is such a thing as getting married in front of a judge, but the state will recognize a marriage officiated by a rabbi or a priest or the like, because historically marriage did have religious roots, even in the United States, right? The United States was founded on Judeo-Christian values, maybe mainly Christian values, to be sure. But marriage always had an undertone of a relationship connected by God, created by God, sanctified by God. So to call something a marriage and make it equal in terms of its elevation and its hierarchy is really what the Gemara is talking about Sodom, in which they legitimated a marriage by a ketubah. But I understand. I mean, your argument has been presented. I've seen some rabbis actually say that as long as this is only a secular development, so maybe it doesn't really impact on anything. But on the other hand, I think it does. I think it sends an educational message. What a government does sends powerful signals to its citizens. And I think it's a dangerous thing. Now, this does bring us to another question, which is a very painful question, a very important question, and a question which we don't necessarily have great, tremendous answers. And that is, what if I want to serve God, I want to keep the Torah, I want to do mitzvot, but I'm not attracted to the opposite gender? My sexual attraction is to the same gender. To some degree, some have argued that there might be some genetic basis for it. Some say not, and some say even if there is a genetic basis, it's connected to environmental triggers, often early child abuse, or whatever it is. But the question basically is, what is the religious homosexual supposed to do with his feelings, his or her feelings? Although I'll talk about the female a little later on. Right now, let's focus on the male, because that's what we started with. Now, you can't just tell a person, it's a sin, can't do it. If you do it, you're an evil person. Because the person is suffering, and you can't dismiss a person's suffering. You have to be compassionate, and you have to address it. So the solutions, quotation marks, that we have in this scenario are not the greatest, and one has to be very, very honest. And this is a problem that rabbis face with their own students and counseling and the like. Solution number one, all of my solutions are in quotation marks. Solution number one is try to change a person's sexual orientation. Now, as you know, this is an extremely controversial measure. The American Psychological Association has come out against it, and we've had some cases where this treatment has been unsuccessful and it has resulted in suicides. So it's a very, very risky and dangerous therapy sometimes. But the truth of the matter is that studies have shown that sexual orientation can be changed in a given percentage. Now, it's not a fantastic percentage, but it's less than 50%, but in around 45 to almost 50% when there is a strong religious motivation for change. It's very interesting that religion can be the most powerful motivator that enables change. And you understand that there's a certain catch-22 in society, because as gayness becomes, if there's such a word, as gayness becomes more and more accepted, there's less of a motivation to change. Why should I change if this is normal? I mean, in a sense, we're creating a catch-22 where the impetus of change is going to be less powerful because it gets more accepted and the like. But I will tell you, I do personally know, and again, I'm not advocating this for everybody because it doesn't always work. I've seen statements signed by rabbis, and it's absolutely wrong. They make the statement that God would never give you a negative condition that you would be incapable of changing. And therefore, by definition, every gay person is capable of changing their sexual orientation. That is absolutely wrong. That's like saying, if you were born with one arm, God will give you another arm if you pray hard enough. In other words, it is a disability. It is a trial. It is a test. God will give you a way to deal with it, but he won't necessarily give you another arm. So to say, God definitionally will give me the way to deal with my being gay by giving me the ability to change my orientation is a very, very dangerous oversimplification. So I'm not saying this is going to work all the time, but it does work sometimes. I personally know of a student in my yeshiva, he used to be there, who told me, I didn't know this, but he told me when he told me that he had been gay, he had been an active practicing homosexual, and he went to what was called aversion therapy and the like, and he's married and has children, and he feels that he's happy. Yeah.
I've heard that it's pretty common that within boy yeshivas that plenty of people do experiment and try it out, and that the solution to that is to have them marry right away.
I think that's a bit of an exaggeration. You are correct. Obviously, in any all male environment, there is a certain amount of homosexual, at least experimentation, that goes on. If you read the blogs, you get the impression that every yeshiva is Sodom and Amorah, and this is going on all the time, and every rabbi is a predator. Again, the way blogs are. I mean, they make it a lot worse.
But I just want to point out, in such an atmosphere where it's so strongly discouraged, and I mean, if it's not necessarily something that has a trigger, if somebody's born that way, I mean, is there a way to change it?
Yes, well, first of all, again, it is very important to note that although there's been a lot of